Hello, beautiful souls. I'm so glad that you could join us on the Learn to Love podcast. I'm your host, Zach Beach, and I'm so excited to introduce our wonderful guest for today's episode, Dr. Alexandra Solomon. Dr. Solomon is the host of the hit podcast, Reimagining Love, and she was a guest on our show more than 2 years ago in episode 18 on Taking Sexy Back. Dr. Alexandra Solomon is internationally recognized as one of today's most trusted voices in the world of relationships. She is a clinician educator, a frequent contributor to academic journals, part of the faculty in the School of Education and Social Policy at Northwestern University, and is a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Dr. Alexandra Solomon came back on the show to talk about her newest book, Love Every Day, 365 Relational Self-Awareness Practices to Help Your Relationship Heal, Grow, and Thrive. Coming out this month, this book offers 365 daily practices to cultivate a curious and compassionate approach to your relationships with others as well as your relationship with yourself. It was such a joy to have her on. So without further ado, let's start the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Learn to Love podcast, your guide to everything love, sex, intimacy, and relationships. Each week, your host, Zach Beach, interviews new experts on love, including couples therapists, relationship coaches, sex educators, and best-selling authors. Learn the best tips and cutting-edge wisdom to better love yourself, others, and the world. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, Dr. Solomon. Thank you so much for coming back onto the show.
Zach, it's so fun that I was here. You had mentioned before we started that I was episode number 18, and now here you are many, many, many episodes later. So I'm happy to see you again.
Yes, I want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for coming on when I was just a little fledgling podcast. And it was so wonderful to have your name pop back into my inbox and to hear more about the amazing work that you have been doing. And you do have a new book that you're coming onto the show to talk about, but just thought I'd check in. How are you today? How's everything over at Northwestern?
Good. Everything is good. I'm not teaching this semester, so I'm feeling a little more disconnected than usual from the campus, but everything is fine in my world. It's just an exciting, busy time. We've got, we emptied our nest. So my husband and I are getting used to being empty nesters and I'm launching a book. So, you know, always something.
I'm always curious, like, how much does your knowledge about psychology and the mind and helping others help you through your own life transitions? Does it make it any easier? Or are you like, nope, this is just as hard?
Right. I've had my husband as a guest on my podcast a couple of times now. And the first time he was on the show, I don't even know what we were talking about, but he said, I want the Reimagining Love listeners to know that you put on your yoga pants one leg at a time, just like the rest of us.
Your yoga pants.
So I do. And I think that there's, you know, at least where I am in my journey now, I am still triggerable, activatable. You know, I still get emotionally pulled into dynamics with my husband, with my family members, with friends, certainly with our kids. So I don't know that I'm ever going to be at a place where, you know, I've reached total equanimity, you know, but what I know to be true is that I notice more quickly than I used to, and probably more quickly than somebody who hasn't been immersed in this world for 20 years. I notice more quickly when I am off. It's a bit easier for me to be self-compassionate and curious when I'm triggered, and I've got the tools I need to repair, to clarify, you know, to kind of stay in a relational place most of the time. So I think that's, you know, I still am. I think no matter how much work we've done on ourselves, our context continues to change, right? So I've not ever, you know, the therapy I've done, the therapy I've received and the therapy I've given certainly help me as I navigate, for example, this empty nest, but I've not ever in my life been in an empty nest. So it's going to be new. It's going to be activating. It's going to be stirring. But I think I've got more tools than I used to have to cope.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I like how you said, no matter how much work we've done, the context will continue to change and we will absolutely encounter new situations that we aren't as prepared for, which I feel like is such a perfect theme for today's show, because it is about love being a daily practice, love being something we are never done with, because of course we do enter into new phases of life, hence the theme of your book, Loving Every Day. So what brought you to this basic idea that love is something, and I know people don't like this word, should practice every day?
Yeah, this has been a really fun book to create. It's my third book and it's a different format. You know, I have so far only written chapter books, you know, that really where the content, you know, builds on each other and you've got to move through the book in a relatively linear way. And this is a 365 book, which I think my whole life I've always loved these one a day formats of books. So it's really fun to now have created one like this, because I think first of all, there's something that feels really generous about like an author giving you something to chew on and think about and work on every day of an entire year. There's something that feels so like kind of generous and giving about that. But it also, what I realized as we were working on the book is that it really does parallel a healing journey or a therapeutic journey, which is we make changes in micro steps. I think sometimes, you know, people, when I'm educating people about therapy, I think it can feel like your therapist is going to give you the insight, you know, that makes your whole story make sense. And I think there can be somewhat of a sense of idealization about what a healing journey is, that you kind of put the pieces together and then you are changed. And that's not really what therapy is, right? It's lots of steps and steps and making one degree of shift and celebrating the hell out of it, you know, and capitalizing on it and going slow and steady. So I think there's that piece that really does kind of parallel this idea of a little bit of work every day. And then I think our intimate relationships, similarly, intimate relationships are not nourished by sweeping romantic gestures or grand declarations. Like those are fun once in a while to have, you know, whatever, the rose petal covered bed or the surprise trip to Napa Valley or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Like those are fun and lovely, but those aren't the kind of like meat and potatoes or like the heart of an intimate relationship. The heart of an intimate relationship are, what are the little things that you are doing each day? What are the ways in which you are mindful of the language you're using? What are the ways in which you are checking in on the quality of connection between you and your partner? And that's really what all the research shows is what makes for a healthy relationship, is that's the little stuff that we do or the little stuff that we stop doing that really makes the space between ourselves and our partner feel good and safe and connected.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was so interesting because when I did hear of your book, Loving Every Day, 365 Relational Self-Awareness Practices, I was like, oh, I'm sure that's been done before. Like, so then I went to Amazon and I was like, 365 love practices, 365 yeah. love. And then nothing came up. And it was so surprising because I do think the reason that almost hasn't been developed yet is because people don't think of love as a practice. They don't think of it as something that we need to do every day. And I love that you did say that even with the therapeutic relationships, people want huge breakthroughs, but change happens iteratively, step by step and day by day.
So yeah. Does that fit for you? Like, I'm thinking about you as a, you know, a podcaster who's like 100 plus episodes in. Like, do you, what have been the shifts that you've made over these 100 plus episodes? Like, do you feel like your kind of like personal shifts and growth through the work you've been doing have been more like sweeping versus micro? Like, what's it been like for you?
For me, I do always come back to the word practice. Anything that we value in life, I find, is a practice. Love, forgiveness, peace, self-compassion. And it is something I'm absolutely committed to. And indeed, every podcast episode I record, I learn new things. I can realize we can never grow too complacent in our love and our relationships, because there's always more growth, more things to learn about and bring in. And speaking, yeah, a little bit to my own personal path, is I do think that love is the reason that we are here on this earth. And I have been, for much of my earlier life, I was really focused on loving others and almost to the point where I forgot about myself. And that's almost been my theme currently in my life, is like, oh, right, can't forget myself and can't forget my own energy and filling up my own cup so that I can continue to be of service to others, which did really feel very much in line with your book, which is all about those self-awareness practices and being mindful of our own energy.
I think there's something really powerful about a man who's talking about losing himself in relationships. I think one of the probably misperceptions that women have about men, that's something that I hear so much from women, is that I'm a people pleaser. I lose myself in relationships. And I think that sometimes feels like it's something that is done to women or asked, you know, that women are asked to be self-sacrificing. And I think it's really important as somebody and your identity and how you show up as a man, that this is also a struggle for you, that you have found that you have been at risk of being so much for other people, adapting, adjusting yourself to what other people want and need from you, that you've had to really check in about, okay, wait, who am I? How do I notice what I'm feeling? Where is my voice? I think that there's something really both brave and important about you talking about that growing edge for you as a man.
Yeah, I appreciate that. It's something I definitely have worked on a lot. And yeah, anytime people kind of do point out gender differences, even when I teach anatomy, I'm like, okay, everyone, the differences within a gender and the variance within a gender are much greater than the difference between genders. Like, sure, we could say the average height of a man is this and the average height of a woman is less, but still we can have, 6 foot tall women and 5 foot tall men. And so I find that is the case in all of the sort of parameters that we might measure people by. Sure, there's a general sense that maybe women are more emotionally intelligent and inclined and men are more straightforward and logical. But you will find countless men out there who are overcome with their emotions and countless women out there who say are not in touch with their own, say, bodies. So there's always people that break the stereotypes that we tend to think about.
I think it's why I don't like when people talk about being in my masculine or being in my feminine, because there's a way that language reiterates and reinforces what is a socially constructed difference, right? I mean, I see it as, as the mother of a son, I see all the really sneaky ways that parents will be boys are so much simpler than girls. I'm like, actually not true. What if we're all equally complicated, but we have taught our boys, we have taught our girls that they're dramatic and we've taught our boys that they are simple, those are just the messages that we as parents even will give, to kids based on their gender that really does a disservice to everybody. The psychology of being a boy or a man is no more simple than the psychology of being a girl or a woman or anywhere in between or beyond those binaries.
Right. Absolutely. It's very self-reinforcing, self-perpetuating.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, men are
tough.
So I'm going to encourage my boy not to cry.
Right. Is he tough or did you just, make him be that way, insist on him being that way? Yeah.
So going back to this idea of love as a practice and loving every day, I am curious, the doctor's recommendation, so to speak, when you read those articles and it's like, we should exercise 25 minutes a day, 3 times a week, is there a certain amount of time that you find is best to be spent cultivating bringing love into our lives intentionally?
I mean, going back to your use of the word practices, I like couples to have practices that aren't necessarily rigid and that, have the ability to kind of flex around the edges. But I know that I think especially for, I think there's different chapters of a couple's story, especially when a couple is raising children or there are really busy careers. It's so easy to place the intimate relationship on the back burner. It's the easiest thing to give and to deprioritize because kids are by nature, going to take up all the oxygen in the room. That is what they're supposed to be doing. And the boundaries now, especially with the transformation of work, in the COVID and post-COVID era, the work, boundaries around work can be so damn fuzzy and work can creep into people's bedrooms and, after work hours and all of that. So I think that if a couple isn't intentional about whatever, the nightly walk after dinner or the weekly couples check-in or the scheduling sex, if those practices aren't in place, they will get taken up by anything and everything else. And I think there are times I definitely have had couples in my practice where my doctor's orders have been less relational conversation. I think there is there is another extreme where couples are spending so much time analyzing their relationships, analyzing what you said and what I said, and that there's not enough space to just do the relationship. So I think sometimes people can get really mired in relationship work. But I think, it's more common for couples to be at the other extreme of just not tending to either more heart-to-heart conversations or just more practices of togetherness where there's a kind of intentionality, something a bit more than falling onto the couch with your phones in your hands or zoning out, with a Netflix show. I think there's time and space for that for sure. But I like the idea of something, a middle space. And then that's why I think a book like this is nice, that a couple can, not every day, but whatever, maybe once a week, twice a week, three times a week, open up the book and work with an entry, read the entry together. I think reading together is such a sweet practice for couples. And then use it as a springboard into a kind of more heart-to-heart conversation.
I love that term, practices of togetherness. And I'm curious if there are any specific ones that you have found particularly useful. And I know every couple is different and every person is different, but you mentioned going on a nightly walk together and reading together. And I am curious if there are just general practices that you encourage couples to do together to practice their togetherness, to not get mired in the the principles, but just build that intimacy.
Yeah. There's a lot of research that shows, especially for established or longer term couples, that putting yourselves in a situation that is novel is really, really good for yourselves as individuals, as a spark for kind of erotic connection, like to be in a novel context together. So whether it's taking a cooking class or a dance class or going to an exhibit at an art museum or going ziplining if you're more, adventurous, like those kinds of things where the two of you are seeing something you haven't seen before, experiencing something together. I think that finding ways to bring in experiences of novelty are so, are incredibly helpful, because it is so much of a long-term relationship is routine and familiarity and seeing your partner in the same context day after day. And there's something that can be quite lovely and essential about that familiarity, but there's something that's really, really important about novelty and kind of experiencing something new together. So I know that sometimes not financially feasible. And I know that it's difficult, time-wise. I think I spend a lot of time also talking with couples about getting out of the idea that a date night needs to be a Saturday night, because that can feel expensive, heavy, idealized, too much. And so I like the idea of a date brunch, a Tuesday morning, date. I think that I want couples to feel a lot of permission to say that a date is whatever the two of you have decided it is, and whatever the two of you are infusing with an energy of, curiosity and setting an intention for experiencing something easeful or joyful together.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Even when I hear the word date, I think of two things. One, dinner and a movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And which is just like the cliche. Yep. And then also that it's something you do at the beginning of a relationship, which is almost just like semantics, because obviously we use the term date, we're not dating anymore. Now we're in a committed partnership. And something I'm hearing from you is actually, first of all, a date was whatever the two of you decided it is. And you want to continue dating each other, continue, buying the flowers and showing up and dressing up and going out and exploring fun new things together, even if you are in that long-term relationship.
It's so important. I think it's certainly something that we lost during COVID, and it's really important. I remember having a couple years and years ago where when they would have a date, they would get ready in different parts of the house. And that kind of just created a little bit of mystery, a little bit of, changing it up, and they would get ready in different parts of the house and then meet, down in the whatever front of their house or out by the car. And that just added a little kind of added layer of specialness.
That's cute.
Yeah.
So your book is based on what you call relational self-awareness, which in the intro you say is an ongoing, curious, and compassionate relationship we each have with ourselves. So I'd love to just hear more about this concept, how you came up with this idea of relational self-awareness. Is this something that you have coined, and did it come out of your research?
Yeah. So as a budding marriage and family therapist yourself, you are learning all these different approaches to how, theories of relationships. You've got your structural family therapist and your emotional. Your brain is full of all those. I stand on the shoulders of giants. I have been trained by some of the best minds in the field, and I've been studying all kinds of approaches to couples therapy, to how couples, create and nurture healthy relationships. I taught and trained marriage and family therapy students for years and years and years, and I am for sure somebody who is integrative by nature. The training program that I taught in for many years, literally the therapeutic approach that we teach and train our students is called integrative systemic therapy. And it is a model of models. It's a bringing together of all the different approaches. So I think that's just the way that my brain works. And so for me, my career has been, it bridges a number of worlds. I spend some of my time in academia, teaching and training. I spend some of my time, doing therapy. And I spend a lot of my time translating research and clinical wisdom into tools for the general public. And so as somebody who is first and foremost, a translator, I have to have ways to make thick, heavy, abstract concepts and data usable for somebody who's not a clinician or not a relationship scientist. And so that's where relational self-awareness has come from. And it reflects my deepest belief that we've got to understand our relationship to relationships, that we come in to our intimate partnerships with all of the experiences that we've had, particularly early in our lives and our families of origin, and then additionally, our prior relationship experiences, how we've gone through dating, commitment, breakup, recovery, starting again, all of that informs who we are in this moment. And I think especially in an intimate partnership, it's so easy to get focused on what the other person is doing and to slip into this mindset of if they would just be different, I wouldn't feel so bad. If they would just stop doing this, it would be easier for me. It's really, and we disempower ourselves when we do that. So relational self-awareness is a set of practices whereby we are committing ourselves to studying our own reactivity. And that does not mean that we blame ourselves for relationship problems, right? It's not moving from blaming our partner to now blaming ourselves, but it's really like learning that systemic thinking muscle where everything that happens in a relationship is my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. Really understanding the patterns, the choreography, the dances, the fact that if I show up for a date and I've got my arms folded and I'm looking at my phone, that shapes what my partner does next, right? Can I take responsibility for the energy I bring into a dynamic with my partner without feeling ashamed about it, but just knowing that I am powerful in my relationship, my tone of voice, my behavior, my, attitude shapes what I get back. And I think it's so easy for us to miss that. So anyway, the long way of saying that relational self-awareness is a process for gently and compassionately taking responsibility for ourselves.
Wow. So much wisdom and such a lovely response. I just want to reiterate a few things. One is that I'm hearing from you almost this basic idea. If you want to change your relationship, change yourself, change how you're coming into it. And so easily we get caught up in, I need to change them. And I love that you've also framed it from a stance of empowerment, that it is disempowering to say that to put all the responsibility on the other person for what's happening in your relationship. And I love the equation that you gave, my stuff plus your stuff equals our stuff. And I want to say it was your book that because I started using this metaphor myself and I was like, did I get it from you where you said relationships are like snow globes?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I was like, that is such a lovely metaphor. So you mentioned that relationships are like snow globes. They're going to bring up all our own stuff. So I'd love to hear more about that when we do talk about the stuff. What is that stuff that gets stirred up?
The stuff is this. It's difficult because in a moment, if I am, for example, frustrated with my husband about something, in that moment, it feels like objective, capital T truth, that he screwed up, that the thing he said was mean or thoughtless or unkind. And I feel like you know, we get into these debates of like, were you being unkind or was I being too sensitive? You know, and that's sort of beside, it's sort of beside the point, right? We don't, I think couples so often argue about objective reality, you know, like, was that thing that you did, like, would everybody agree with me that that thing you did was wrong? And that doesn't really matter. What matters is if my feelings are hurt, our best and bravest move is for the two of us to look at both elements of it. Is my husband's tongue sharper than usual because of something going on inside of him? Like, to what degree is his tongue perhaps sharper than usual because of stress, because of feeling disconnected from me, yada, yada? And to what degree is my skin thinner than usual based on what I'm feeling and experiencing or based on my wounds from the past? And so that's when new possibilities open up, rather than figuring out who screwed up. Am I too sensitive or are you too mean? There's a much more interesting conversation to have about what's going on inside of you and what's going on inside of me. So that's some of what, like, of helping a couple shift from just like playing this, you know, who's the victim and who's the perpetrator game, to looking at, why am I particularly at risk of feeling hurt or misunderstood or frustrated by this thing in this moment? Is it because I'm tender because we're new empty nesters? Is it an old wound that comes from family of origin where I tend to feel overly responsible or, you know, not worthy? So those are the more interesting kinds of conversations. But what we know to be true is that it's the snow globe idea. Our relationships are going to stir up stuff inside of us that goes far beyond just what happened in this moment. We have to get out of this text you sent or this thing you said and get more curious about the bigger, the deeper tenderness, the way in which we're primed to feel hurt in particular ways, and kind of go from there.
So I love everything that you're saying. And I just want to repeat, what matters is if my feelings are hurt, the best and bravest move is to look at how both parties are contributing, because it's not just about what's happening in the moment, but all our previous wounds and conditioning and beliefs. And we don't want to get into this game of victim and perpetrator. And I love it, but I want to challenge you a little bit, because I'm like, that seems really hard. I feel like I could almost only do this if like the couple's therapist is in the room who can kind of like point it out and guide it. So if I am, say, at home in the kitchen or something, and I'm like, okay, wow, there are some challenging dynamics that are happening right now. Maybe both partners are feeling hurt, and we're both not even aware of the wounds that are being stirred up and pressed and the buttons that are pressed in that moment. What can we do?
Yeah, I think it is true. One piece of it is when you have a situation where both people's feelings are hurt and both people are feeling misunderstood, it's really, really hard to ask a couple in that moment to get curious about what's happening inside of themselves and inside of each other, because we are that like mutually activated place is, you know, it's, we feel too misunderstood to make any attempt to be understanding. So a lot of what I help couples do is just press pause, right? Like, things that are complicated, tender, when, you know, each of you are activated, like, there's not a lot of good that comes from continuing to go at that point. And so pressing pause, saying, let's take a timeout and step away, it's a huge relationship skill. It cannot be underestimated at all. And I love, you know, I love the language of like, I love us too much to keep talking right now, or I need some space. A lot of times it is just, you know, and John Gottman's research has shown that like when people are activated, it really, really is hard to regulate and shift in the moment. Like, oftentimes you do need a pause and a break and a stepping away. And it's in that stepping away that people can start to have some clues about why is this thing so tender for me? Like, why am I so like going to the mat on this one? What are the pieces that have to do with like my family of origin? What are the pieces that have to do with prior experiences with this partner? But it's oftentimes like we need some space to do that, and we need to calm our systems down to do that. So I think in a moment when two people are feeling hurt, misunderstood, angry, a lot of it is about pressing pause and just not doing more damage. Because once we've gotten lost in the cycle or lost in the dynamic, the cycle has taken over. So I'm going to start to say the same things I say to you every single time we're in the cycle. And we just are having another experience of same old, same old. And so one of the skills that I want couples to develop is just the ability to like pause and step away.
I love that phrase. I love us too much to keep talking right now.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a perspective that starts to open up with space. You know, there's a way that then I can come back and say, yes, my feelings are hurt. And I know no part of you walks around trying to figure out how you're going to hurt me. You know, the impact of your words was hurtful and your intent was benign. I know that you're not, you know, so that's a very different way of coming at it. And I can apologize. I think that in nearly every conflict I've ever met with a couple, there's a piece that each partner can apologize for. There's an apology that can be made for each part of it, right? And so I think the more we're able to kind of keep an eye out for what's the way in which I don't like how I showed up in that painful moment, the more I'm willing to make the apology for the thing that I didn't like that I did, the more I invite you to take responsibility and accountability and make an apology for the part that you did.
So it's interesting to me that we're talking all about like the really challenging conflicts that come up in relationship. And I almost have this sort of meta question, like, why aren't relationships easier? Like, why can't it just be nice and sunshine and rainbows? Particularly because you might read certain research that says that we're born for love and we're wired for love and there's nothing more natural than to love another and it's fundamental to the human experience. And I kind of want to combine this question with one I had already planned to say, because an interesting little tidbit I read in your book was about betrayal, where you write, almost half of betrayed partners meet the clinical criteria for PTSD in the wake of discovery or disclosure, which first of all was surprising to see. But then again, like why does it have to be so bad? Like why do breakups are so
why does it all hurt so much?
Yes, exactly.
Why do we do this to each other?
Beautiful all the time.
Right? I know. Well, I think that we are. I think it's an exciting moment. I think there's a really cool, like, I love this gentle parenting movement or mindful parenting movement or conscious parenting movement where parents are really committing themselves to healing their own shit so that they can raise the next generation differently. So we may get to what I hope in my lifetime we move to a place where people come into intimate partnership with less baggage, with more skills. Like, you know, I've been teaching this undergraduate relationship education class for like 22 years now. And I tell you what, my college students today are so much more sophisticated than my college students were 20 years ago. Like they come in, they've already done therapy. They know their attachment strategies. They know their love languages. Like they've got some tools on the, you know, in their toolkit already that was not the case 20 years ago. So maybe we're moving to a place where there will be, I mean, I would love to live in a world where there's less infidelity. Infidelity, you know, infidelity is a whole episode unto itself, but it happens so often. We don't have excellent numbers, but it's, you know, a quarter-ish of all relationships experience infidelity. And then, as you're saying, nearly half of people who've been betrayed by an intimate partner in that way develop symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's incredibly common and incredibly painful. And it is a massive symptom of a struggle to practice relational self-awareness, right? We cannot be aligned and whole and unfaithful. You know, I mean, it is a symptom that something is off. Doesn't mean you're a terrible person. Doesn't mean you are incapable of healing, but it means you are living out of your own alignment. And it means that you are most likely, somebody who's cheating is most likely acting out some kind of an old wound that they had long before they felt misunderstood, disrespected, and disengaged from their current partner. So yeah, but I would love to see that number of, you know, 25-30% of all couples struggle with infidelity. I would love for that to become just zero, you know? I would love, because it is such a common way that people hurt each other, and it's so painful and so hard to recover from whether the couple stays together or ends a relationship. Because even if a relationship ends in the wake of betrayal, the one who cheated has got to go on their own journey of understanding, why did I do that? And the answer has got to be, you know, something more interesting than just like, I didn't feel respected by my partner. No, that's a victim story. You got to figure out what set you up to live out of your own alignment. And the one who's been betrayed has to do their own work of figuring out, how do you tend to a broken heart like that to either open it again to your partner or to open it again down the road to a new partner, you know?
Absolutely. I love how you mentioned that things are getting better.
It almost reminds me
of these... it reminds me of these memes where like my boomer grandfather says I can't even fix a sink, and then I reply, well, at least I can tell my son that I love him. And like the progression, of love
that's
and emotional intelligence and sharing of responsibilities and different things like that. But you're absolutely right. I mean, the key insight that I'm hearing is, you know, part of the reason love is hard is because we aren't taught. You know, we don't have this, we weren't taught about loving relationships. And hence the reason for this podcast, hence the reason for your work in the world, is to really disseminate this information and equip people with the skills so that there isn't as much conflict in the relationships. Like we could say, why can't people make chicken cordon bleu? And it's like, no one ever told them.
That's right. And I think that's the grandpa, the little meme about the grandpa, I think it is so incredibly true. And the grandpas of the world, you know, didn't grow up in a time when they were taught to tend to their hearts. And, you know, I think like shifting those, like rather than sort of blaming a grandpa for not being able to say, I love you, I think we can sort of honor that limitation and know that our own transformation. You know, my friend Terry Real has this beautiful quote that's like so famous now, you know, where he talks about how when we do that, we offer healing to the next generation and healing to the ancestors as well, right? Like it creates this, like we become part of this like transformational legacy where like grandpa couldn't do what I can do. And my son will get to do things that I can't, you know, I haven't been able to do. And so it just kind of, we become part of this like flow of shifting. But yeah, that is really true that we're capable of new possibilities for a relationship today that were not possible a generation or certainly two generations ago.
Yeah, I love that emphasis. Like we are passing the baton to the next generation, and along with like the skills to be successful in life, we can also pass down love so that they can increase that as they raise their own children.
Yeah, still good to know how to fix a sink. Not an either or, more of a both and.
Yeah. So your book is divided into 9 themes, and the first 3 of which seem to me focus a lot on self-love. You have healing from the past, practicing self-compassion, and honoring your feelings. And I'd love to hear more about how those skills of self-love do make our relationships have more ease and connection.
Yeah. I think when we are struggling to practice self-compassion, when we are struggling to validate our own feelings, we set our partners up to give us something that we can't, if we can't give it to ourselves, we're going to expect our partner to give it to us. And that often becomes really burdensome to a partner. It's really burdensome to demand compassion from a partner when we, you know, because we're not able to offer it to ourselves. It's really burdensome to demand that our partner validate our experience because we are struggling to validate it for ourselves. And I think sometimes we don't even know that that's what we're doing. But I think, you know, we're in a much better place to raise a concern with a partner when we already have validated it for ourselves. When the question of our own worth is not on the line, we can come into a conversation with our partner with the stakes being a bit lower. I don't need to fight for my worthiness if I've already kind of anchored within myself. I can reach for you differently versus if I'm questioning my own worth, if I'm questioning the validity of my perspective, I'm going to be much more demanding and insistent, and the stakes are going to feel much, much higher. I'm asking something of you that is so, it's just so high, it becomes such so high stakes.
It's so interesting because when you say, if we can't give it to ourselves, we will expect our partner to give it to us. And so true, especially in the emotional world. But I'm also curious if that applies to the sexual world. Like, do you find that even partners with, say, sexually fulfilling relationships with each other still have that self-love, like they enjoy masturbation with themselves to the same extent?
I think that for sure. I think that couples, I think two things can be true at once. Couples really deeply enjoy their sex lives and still really deeply enjoy masturbation. And I think especially for those with vulvas, it's, you know, partner, if you have a vulva and you know how to experience an orgasm on your own, you're far more likely to be able to experience an orgasm with your partner. So I think especially for people with vulvas, that ability to understand and own your own pleasure is really essential then, because it becomes a foundation that you bring into partnered sex. But it is, I think similarly, if the idea is we can only have partner experiences if we are a couple, then I am at the mercy of my partner's desire. I'm at the mercy of my partner's libido. I'm at the mercy of my partner's interest. And that becomes heavy, and it's so easy for couples to then get polarized, versus what you're proposing and reminding us is that there can be space for both partnered and solo sexual experiences, because it's a way of kind of sparing your partner that sense of like responsibility for your sexuality.
I love that. Reminds me of that phrase that we have to love our partner so that they still feel free. And the more we can meet our own needs, the more it frees them up to be available when they too are available.
And then we know, and then when they are available, we know that they're available because they want to be rather than because they feel like they should be, or, you know, they have a duty to us of some kind. Like, that doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to go into a sexual experience with a partner feeling like they're just here to check the box. You know, we want our partner to feel, we want to feel, have that felt sense that like my partner's here because they want to be here. So, yeah.
So it's been such a joy speaking with you, Dr. Selman. You're just a fountain of wisdom, and I wish we could spend hours together because you have so much insight. And as we're winding down, there's the final question I ask all my guests, but I want to ask one question before as kind of a segue, because earlier you said we have to understand our relationship to relationships, which I thought was very interesting because there's a lot of, say, narratives coming out nowadays, you know, kind of like Esther Perel is kind of big on this, that our expectations and pressures we put on modern romantic relationships are sky high. And we expect one person to fulfill what a whole village used to do. And we have certain fairy tale Disney based ideas on what relationships are. So yeah, what is your take on just a healthy relationship serving view of relationships?
Yeah. I just posted on Instagram yesterday, the day before, that I think in our culture, we tend to eroticize enmeshment, meaning that we have this notion that, right, if you're the one, if you're my soulmate, I will have no upper limit on togetherness. You know, I will always want to be with you. I will always want more of you. And I think the hallmark of a healthy relationship is really deeply appreciating togetherness and really deeply being able to tolerate separateness and aloneness and space. And I think that is, you know, that's one of the hallmarks of secure attachment, right? Is when we are apart, I can remember you, I can trust you, I can feel, I can regulate myself. You know, I think that's where couples get into trouble, when there's like so much, you know, kind of feeding off of each other and fear of being apart. And, you know, so I do think that we need both space and connection in relationship for sure.
I love that. Secure attachment allows for space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So my final question I ask all of my guests is, what do you wish everyone knew about love?
I guess I would have to say what I wish everyone knew about love is that it is a potent vehicle for growth and healing. And that, what is that Rumi? There's a beautiful Rumi quote about that we're made of love, but we sort of forget that, or we put up barriers, or that we, you know, that is, I think when we frame it the way that you were framing it earlier, that we are made of love, that our, you know, this is our primary way of being is loving, but stuff gets in the way. I think when we frame it that way, like that stuff gets in the way, then the question is not whether or not I'm loving. It's just what's blocking, what's getting in the way. And that's just such a more like health promoting view of it, is it's not that I'm forgetful, or I'm blocked, or I've lost my center, but really my heartbeat is to be loving, to be gentle, to be caring, to be kind. Like, that is my heartbeat. And if I'm not behaving in those ways, it's because something is getting in the way.
My heartbeat is to be loving. I love that. You can just put our hands on their heart and it says, love, love, love. thank you so much, Dr. Alexandra Solomon. New book, Love Every Day, 365 Relational Self-Awareness Practices to Help Your Relationship Heal, Grow, and Thrive. For our listeners that want to learn more about you, how can they find you?
The best way is my website, dralexandrasolomon.com. And there you will find the entire ecosystem of blogs and podcasts and books and e-courses and links to social media. And I'm also active on Instagram @dr.alexandra.solomon.
Cool. And you're still doing your podcast or?
Reimagining Love every week.
Wonderful. Every week,
yeah.
All right. Be sure to tune into that as well. So thank you again for taking time out of your busy day, for giving us so much insight and wisdom into not only loving others, but also ourselves. Take care.
Thanks, Zach. So nice to be with you.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to the show. We hope you remember many of the valuable lessons that Dr. Solomon shared with us today, including changes in our life happen step by step, which is why it's important to make love a practice. One of the strongest practices for togetherness is exploring new things together, knowing that a date is whatever you want it to be. If you want to change your partner, change yourself. Show up in a loving way and learn about how to manage and be with your own stuff. In the heat of the moment, it's okay to take breaks, perhaps even using the phrase, "I love us too much to keep talking right now." If we can't meet our own needs, we will expect and depend on our partner to give it to us, which puts a lot of pressure on them. So start with self-love. And remember to love. Our heartbeat is made to love. If you want to learn more about me, you can go to zachbeach.com and learn more about the show at theheartcenter.com. Take care.
Thanks again for listening to the Learn to Love podcast. To learn more about the show and your host, head over to zachbeach.com or theheartcenter.com. You can also follow Zach on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.